Hello and welcome to our blood chemistry section on blood sugar. This is one of my favorite sections to teach because I love talking about blood sugar and I love the kind of results I get when we get people's blood sugar in balance. So this is not intended to be the comprehensive treatment of blood sugar, obviously. We have a whole blood sugar module to do that, but this is to just pull out all the labs that we generally use to really delve into what labs are in our general blood chemistry and are expanded, but also to teach you a little bit about some of the more advanced stuff related to autoimmune diabetes and some of the levels in antibodies that you can test. This is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, not medical advice. It's intended to be me sharing with you, you sharing with your clients in an educational way. And if they're under the care of a doctor, make sure that they run it by their doctor before they make severe decisions. Blood sugar markers. We all know that fasting blood sugar, while it's a semi-useful indicator, it's not really useful at all when it comes to subtle signs. Fasting blood sugar is great for diagnosing or indicating that a person has diabetes. We have ranges, but it's really the last thing that changes. And there's so many other things that change before that. And that's where we want to be stepping in and helping people to prevent going down the diabetes route and pick up the early warning signs so that it's not after they've been diagnosed that they start to heed and take action. So the fasting blood sugar, I like it to be between 75 and 85. There's a number of studies that indicate that once it hits 90, the risk of heart disease goes up dramatically, like, you know, tenfold is some of the studies. And the higher it goes, the more that risk is. Triglycerides are related to blood sugar, and we know that the triglyceride HDL ratio is one of our most important markers. The ideal is in the 50 to 100 range. I like to see it more like 75. That's a really nice ideal triglycerides. Insulin is another marker that we don't often do. We don't do it often enough. I wish it was included on a standard blood panel. It's not that expensive to add it, like $25 or $30, something like that. But if you do the insulin, there's two ways you want to do it in order to get some good information. You want to measure the insulin on fasting. And ideally, you want it as close to 2 as possible, between 2 and 5. That's how much insulin is this person putting out when they're not eating any food. The postprandial insulin is actually a really good number to have. And it's even more important for discovering how advanced somebody is in terms of a type 2 diabetic. But also, in by itself, without the fasting, doesn't tell us a whole lot. So if somebody has a really ideal fasting insulin of 2, but their after eating insulin, also called postprandial, is something like 80 or 90, you know that fasting blood glucose numbers are not going to give us a true picture. We're going to see a lot of blood sugar swings if we were to test their glucose. And their body's responding with huge amounts of insulin along the way. Here's something that I wish we could do. Insulin is too hard to measure in a little kit that we get, like the glucose strips. It has to be vacuum sealed, and there's some special handling that has to happen to the blood after you draw it. So it's not something we can do at home. However, there are some insulin kits that you can take at home, and they have you do some special stuff, but you have to take it off to the lab. There is a blood spot insulin test. The ideal would be you test it fasting, and then you test it postprandial. Insulin curve will be very similar to a glucose curve, and we know that from all the charts that we had in our insulin resistance section. If you know that the person has a peak glucose at around the 45-minute mark, that's about when you want to take the insulin, give or take 15 minutes. And that way you'll see what their peak insulin is. And we know that the higher the insulin goes, the more damage you get to the endothelial linings, the more permanent damage, the stiffening, the stuff that really puts people at high risk. So it's really good to know what that is. Interestingly enough, I was reading an article and a medical doctor was talking about this person who had had all the signs of insulin resistance. She had the belly fat. She was brain fogged. She was exhausted. And every time they measured her blood glucose, no matter when they measured her glucose, it was normal at all the different peaks. What happened with this woman, she had perfect blood sugars all the time. She had all the signs of insulin resistance. And her fasting insulin was normal. So they decided to do postprandials. And he was finding that her postprandial insulins were going up to 90. 90. And this was happening. She was like this for years. He'd been working with her for years and couldn't figure this out. Postprandial insulins of 90. And he said, this is the most amazing case because this is someone who just the insulin was working. It was high levels. It had to keep going higher and higher and higher to work. But her body was still able to produce those high levels. And usually what happens is the pancreas burns out. They can't produce the levels that it takes in order to get it upstream and into the blood, into the cells. And so the blood sugar starts to go up. So it's everybody's a little bit differently. So if you are working with somebody, you go, classic insulin resistance. What's going on here? Why is it not showing? Check their postprandial insulin. Really important to do. And what you do is have them eat and then go to the lab and make sure that they're at the lab to get their blood drawn right at about the 45-minute mark or wherever their peak is. The idea would be they sit in the office with their blood sugar meter and they know what their peak usually is and they catch it at peak and then they get their blood drawn. But you can't always time it that way when you're dealing with a busy lab. So if any of these are out of balance and this is showing that there's a blood sugar problem, I always like to follow with a hemoglobin A1C or get the person to check their glucose meter. The hemoglobin A1C is a nice number to have because that way you know what their long-term insulin or glucose levels were, the average glucose. So for example, if that person has a hemoglobin A1C of about 5.6, which is still considered normal before it moves into insulin resistance, 5.7 is considered moving into insulin resistance. But what that means is that their average blood glucose is around 119. And that's a little bit high, right? We talk about not letting it go above 110. The average is 119. That means that counts in when they're sleeping, in between meals. So clearly that number is off. I like to see that hemoglobin A1C between 4.5 and 5. So if fasting glucose is high and hemoglobin A1C is normal, it could be a vitamin B1 deficiency. And you'll also see if that's the case, the carbon dioxide, the bicarbonate, less than 25, so in the acidic range, and LDH, which we'll talk about in the liver section, above 140, because it indicates a hypoglycemia situation. So let's talk about hemoglobin A1C. It's an indirect measure of the blood sugars over a 120-day period. The glucose gets attached to the hemoglobin when the levels are high, and they call it glycosylation, so glycosylated hemoglobin. It's irreversible. The good news is the blood cells will replace themselves after 120 days. So it's not like it's irreversible damage as if that damage was to a blood vessel lining that couldn't get repaired. So it's a good long-term measure. It's used in diabetes. Oftentimes diabetics are measured and they have A1Cs of like 11. And a diabetic is considered controlled if it's around 7, which I think is ludicrous because that's an average blood glucose of around 140. When the glucose is high or low, you want to follow up for diabetes, okay? Because sometimes people are in a pre-diabetic state and their blood glucose is super low. Like they'll eat a meal and very shortly after it goes way low because of the hypoglycemia. So either way, it's a blood sugar problem, whether it's hypo or hyper. It's really the same problem. It's just different stages. Okay, so hemoglobin A1C can be depressed. So if it's below 4.5, this person might be hypoglycemic, but can also be hemolytic anemia. Remember, we talked about that blood loss in pregnancy. So going back to our anemia markers, if they have some of these anemia markers, severe iron deficiency and ferritin deficiency, and they also have decreased A1C, that's the time to refer them for a consultation to see if they have some occult blood loss going on in their body. We've got hypoglycemia, insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, diabetes. We've got all these different stages of blood sugar imbalance. And each of these stages is going to have a different presentation in terms of their numbers. So let's look at some of those numbers. Insulin resistance. If the glucose is above 100 but less than 120, that person's considered in insulin resistance. If their hemoglobin A1C is greater than 5.7, it's considered insulin resistance. If their fasting insulin is greater than 5, it's considered insulin resistance. And then the big one, the easy one to tell, which is not always accurate, I can attest to that personally, is the waist-hip ratio. Oftentimes, you just look at a person and you go, oh my God, this person's insulin resistant, right? Because they've got the big belly and the smaller hips. So if in a male, you see that the waist-hip ratio is greater than one, meaning that the waist is greater than the hips, then for sure you suspect insulin resistance. In a woman, if it's more than 80% or the waist is greater than 35 inches, then you definitely consider it a very high risk of insulin resistance. And it doesn't always happen that way. I discovered I had insulin resistance, or at least pre-insulin resistance, maybe. I had pre-insulin resistance without the waist-hip ratio off and without the high glucose, without going above 100. I have very, very good control of my first morning, my fasting glucose, but I was all over the map afterwards. And that's, I guess we'd call that pre-insulin resistance, which is where we really want to catch people. So I can get that under control before it ends up, you know, like my grandmother with the diabetes. So metabolic syndrome is really insulin resistance with some lipid abnormalities. So really it puts people at much higher risk of cardiovascular disease. Generally speaking, we're going to see their triglycerides greater than 110. And for those of you outside the U.S., that converts to 1.24 millimoles per liter. Total cholesterol of greater than 220 or 5.69 in the SI system. HDL cholesterol of less than 55 or 1.42. Glucose of greater than 100. Fasting insulin of greater than 5. High blood pressure. Hemoglobin A1C 5.7. And the waist-hip ratio off. This is classic for metabolic syndrome. Now, if they have most of these symptoms and not all of them, or most of these markers, that's, you just kind of pull it all together, right? And especially if you see that belly, like in this picture, for sure, there's some insulin resistance going on. And if all those lipid numbers are off, we call it metabolic syndrome. So let's look at how we assess it. Generally, for medicine, it has to be greater than 120 on two tests to assess as diabetes. And the hemoglobin A1C has to be greater than 6.5. Cholesterol greater than 220, triglycerides greater than 110, HDL less than 55, and blood pressure increased. Really, the only ones that we really need that they actually use is the first one and possibly the second one as well. The glucose above 120 on two tests and hemoglobin A1C greater than 6.5. Normally after a meal, glucose goes up, insulin gets secreted by the pancreas, and that causes the insulin to bind to the cell membranes, triggers those glucose receptors, says, open up, I got some sweets for you, dumps the glucose in, and also amino acids, fats, magnesium, and other nutrients, all gets transported into the cell through this thing right here, which is your receptor. And then once the nutrients are cleared from the blood, the pancreas stops secreting insulin. That's normal. That's the way it's supposed to be. When the insulin binds to the cell, it causes that cell to prefer the use of glucose over fat as fuel. So even if you've got some fats in the bloodstream that have been released from your fats, those are going to go back if you're eating a bunch of sugar and it triggers this insulin response. The other effect of insulin binding also inhibits the fat burning by the cells. So when the insulin binds to the cells, they can't burn fat. Why not? Because why burn fat? We've got all the sugar that we need. It also inhibits growth hormone. And as you recall, growth hormone is important for growth and repair, for putting down lean muscle mass and burning fat. Insulin and growth hormone in this regard are polar opposites. So whenever the insulin goes up, the growth hormone, it just goes away, it goes down again. The other important part of this insulin binding is it slightly depresses thyroid effects by blunting conversion from T4 to T3. So if we're constantly in this state of high insulin, we're going to have sluggish thyroid, which is going to further contribute to the weight issue. So what happens when we have insulin resistance? And again, this should all be review, but might not be. Either the circulating insulin doesn't bind to the cells, or it binds, but the effects are deficient because it doesn't have the right nutrients to get through. You know, say it goes and binds, but there's not enough chromium to secrete it through, or magnesium. The pancreas just keeps secreting more insulin as long as that blood sugar stays up. It says, okay, more, okay, more, okay, more. And what that does is leaves your insulin up high for a long time, which causes damage to the blood vessel linings. It causes excessive blood pressure, and it's a very big risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And then any cells that are insulin resistant are going to have deficient function. So your liver cells, your untrained muscle, fat cells, they're all going to be having problems. So let's look at the negative effects of insulin resistance, deficient function in the insulin resistant cells. So we have cells that there's all this sugar and there's all this extra fat being stored, but the cells are not getting enough energy to actually do an efficient job. Excess anabolic effects, meaning increased body fat, especially around the middle. Oxidation in non-insulin resistant cells, because these cells are exposed to the excess insulin. So you get damage to the blood vessel linings. Systemic inflammation, it increases inflammatory markers like CRP. Hypertension is one of the negative effects because the blood thickens, you retain water, and the fat burning is suppressed. And then a lot of adverse systematic effects like blunted growth hormones and thyroid hormones, which leads to body-wide effects. So we all know that it's really important to get this resolved. So we're going to look at some other things, so some other markers. This is outside the realm of blood chemistry, but there are definitely things that we can be looking at. What causes the insulin resistance is super important. So when you see these numbers, you'll be looking for what other things might be causing it. There's the genetics, there's omega-3 deficiencies, the omega-6-3 ratio, deficiencies of our specific nutrients we talk about, chromium, magnesium, zinc, B vitamins, possibly boron, lithium, lack of resistance exercise, manual labor and trained muscle mass, sugar, processed foods, starches, fruit juices and sodas, stress, insufficient protein or protein malabsorption. So all of these things contribute to insulin resistance. And we know how to test it. You get a blood sugar meter. There's a lot of them. But you can also get your own home hemoglobin A1C test. But I will warn you, if you're going to be having people do that, it is a complicated test. So don't give it to the people who are having trouble following directions. I ruined two of them, and they're like $12 a piece. So I ruined two of them because I didn't read the instructions well. They're not easy like the glucose. There's some things you have to do. Measuring blood glucose at home is super amazing when you can, you know that it's expensive and it takes time to go to the labs. Well, they measure their fasting blood sugar, write down the test meal, measure the glucose immediately after the meal, measure it every half hour, measure it an hour after the meal, and then every hour at 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours. Now, even better is to get people to measure it 15 minutes, every 15 minutes for the first 90 minutes. Glucose tolerance test results. When you do that, the max should be 110. The ideal peak is actually 99 to 100. And you never have the sugar dip below the starting point. If any of these is not happening, then you're talking to the person about how to get their glucose and their insulin under control. Consequences of insulin resistance. We've got cardiovascular disease, hypertension, leptin resistance, weight loss resistance, fatty liver, impaired detoxification. And here's a biggie. Insulin resistance can lead to androgen dominance, meaning male sex hormones, and lead to PCOS. And we see this a lot. We see it a lot in teenagers who are having difficulties getting their period. A lot of acne. They're gaining weight. We look, they have PCOS, which is polycystic ovarian syndrome. And the funny thing about it, polycystic ovarian syndrome, you'd think they have multiple cysts on their ovaries, and that's not always the case. The other thing it can cause is a glutathione reduction, and that decreases phase 2 liver detox. So we have a backup of toxins, which then further increases the weight because those toxins have to be stored somewhere. And it's actually been linked to cancers, pancreatic, colon, and breast. There are some medications that hinder the insulin regulation, so you always want to do a good history on a person to see that they're not taking any of these drugs. Anti-seizures, corticosteroids, birth control pills, estrogen replacements, diuretics. Hypoglycemia is caused by alcohol, insulin, hypertension medications, and oral diabetes medications. So there's medications that will get in the way. Here's my favorite part. Is this stuff nobody's talking about? Latent autoimmune diabetes in adults, LADA. I came upon this and started studying it as I was seeing people who who they'd come to see me and they'd explain that they were type 2 diabetics and they were on their medication and the medication wasn't working. And I'd look at them and they didn't look like type 2 diabetics. They weren't overweight. They didn't look it. They looked more like a type 1 diabetic. And the fact that their medications weren't working and they were saying they had to go on insulin, that doesn't make sense for type 2 diabetes. And usually the person that that's the case of, like, they've worn their pancreas out and they go from type 2 to have to be dependent on insulin, they usually overweight. They usually show the signs. These people were not showing these signs. I'm like, what's going on here? So I started looking into it. I came across LADA, latent autoimmune diabetes in adults. So there's a number of things that you can measure if you're suspecting this. If you have somebody who is actually, you know, doing some of the protocols, you know, they come in and they're not on a terrible diet and they are just not being able to make it with their medications. So their first thing is glutamic acid decarboxylase antibodies. What the heck is that? Glutamic acid decarboxylase is an enzyme that converts glutamine to GABA, or glutamate to GABA. And GABA is a neurotransmitter that's calming. It's a good bedtime neurotransmitter. And glutamate is excitatory. Now, what the heck does this have to do with diabetes and the pancreas? And I was on a mission to find this out. And what I found out was the mechanism is really not clear after going through a whole bunch of research papers. But basically, there's a production of this, of GABA in the pancreas. Who would have known, right? GABA is a neurotransmitter. You expect it to be produced in the brain. It's actually produced in the pancreas. And the glutamic acid decarboxylase will convert the glutamate to GABA. Now, we weren't able to tell from the studies how GABA affects it and how glutamate. Is it the buildup of the glutamate due to these antibodies that causes a problem, or is it the decreased GABA? And I couldn't find anything that was real clear about that. But suffice it to say, if a person has glutamic acid decarboxylase antibodies, they're going to have, that's the first, one of the best signs of autoimmune diabetes. The other signs can be real obvious. We think this is the most common one, insulin antibodies. Antibodies that attack the person's own insulin. And that's commonly associated with LADA too. Islet cell antibodies. Islet cells are those little cells within the pancreas that make the insulin. So what if we attack these cells and they can't make insulin anymore? Voila, we have elevated blood sugar. We have diabetes. There's another set of antibodies called the zinc transporter autoantibodies. And they attack a protein that's responsible for the uptake of zinc in the membrane of the insulin secretory granules. So that causes a problem if there's antibodies to that. Tyrosine phosphokinase antibodies attack a protein that regulate the cytokine-induced pancreatic beta cell apoptosis. What the heck does that mean? Cytokines are inflammatory chemicals. The pancreas beta cells produce the insulin, and apoptosis is programmed cell death. So we may end up with this, the regulation of apoptosis being off. So too much apoptosis or not enough apoptosis. Not enough apoptosis means that cells live way beyond their useful life and they're taking up space and you don't get a good response that way. And finally, we have something called C-peptide. C-peptide mainly measures the residual beta cell function by determining how much insulin is being secreted. So this one's a good one to do and is especially going to be low in a long-term diabetic who's had this problem for a while. Now, if any of these are positive, it's suspicion for LADA, the autoimmune, latent autoimmune diabetes in adults. If two or more, or three or more, four or more, you see, get the idea, it's more likely. The glutamic acid decarboxylase and the C-peptide tend to be the ones that are most commonly done. But all the rest of them can be done and are often done. A lot of them are done in research. So if you've never seen this before, this is something to look out for. Well, finally, we've got a blood sugar case. Let's take a look at it. We've got somebody with a blood glucose of 74. So glucose 74, I don't think it's terribly low as a fasting glucose, but you know, it depends on how the person's feeling. If I'm doing like a juice cleanse or a fast, my fasting blood sugars can be in the 60s and sometimes even lower.
and I still feel fine.
The TSH in this person is high, 7.17, and their free T3 is low. But remember we said that with the insulin resistance, we can get a decrease in the T4 to T3 conversion. And their LDH is very high. LDH that high can be indicative of a liver problem, but it can also be indicative of a glucose regulation problem in terms of hypoglycemia. So that concludes our blood sugar. I hope I gave you enough information about how to detect the typical blood sugar imbalances, how to detect blood sugar balances long before the medical profession will do that for your client, because they're just not aware of all these subtle nuances. Now you can help people prevent getting into diabetes, predict that they might be moving towards it well in advance, and distinguish between a type 2 diabetes and a type 1 that's a latent adult onset. And those are critical things, because you are going to see people that come across your office that are not the textbook classic cases, and you have to be prepared and aware.